evening, everyone. Nice to have you all here. Okay, 12-3415, Brotherhood Maintenance versus Norfolk. And hello, you're Mr. Sandville, yes?
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Harry Zanville. I'm from San Diego, California, and I have the honor. Am I starting too soon for you?
You have to come here from there. Well, that's how it goes, huh? Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a bit of sense of history. It's the first argument I ever gave in an appellate court was in this court in 1974, I believe, and so this may be one of my last, and I'm very honored to be here to represent my client.
What month in 74?
What month in 74?
Yeah.
I would hope it was in the fall, but I really can't remember.
Since I came aboard in December of 74, I wondered if our paths crossed that long ago.
It was a case involving Judge Morgan and his decision in the district court to exclude Hispanics from jury duty.
Wow.
I'm pleased to be here today. I represent the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way Employees, which is an organization of railroad workers, 35,000 of them, who maintain the tracks and bridges in the United States. My clients are rarely in the federal courts. They are extremely reticent to be here. They fully understand and appreciate the major-minor dichotomy of disputes under the Railway Labor Act. We actually did a study as to how often, how infrequently we appear, and that's part of the record in this case. It's extraordinary for us to be here, but there were extraordinary facts that caused us to file this case. We filed actually two cases, and they were both filed because of historic misconduct by the Norfolk Southern Railroad.
Here's what we need to do. We need to know where in the record we will find admissible evidence that Norfolk knowingly and repeatedly submitted false expert reports in these disciplinary proceedings. In other words, where's the evidence given by someone with personal knowledge of these particular facts? And I guess, specifically, where in the record will we find your best evidence that the Hughes reports were false and that Norfolk knew they were false?
With regard to demonstrating in the record that the Hughes evidence was false and misleading, some of the best evidence comes from Mr. Hughes himself in his deposition, where he fully and frankly admitted that he was unqualified to give the opinions he was giving. And he had preceded that by saying, oh, to give an engineering opinion, it's got to be 99% accurate. And then he proceeded to say, but I had no basis on which to give the opinions. The opinions he was giving were included, and the core of them were to say, oh, these injured workers could not have been injured in the manner and to the extent that they said they were. And he did that based on two principal documents that he had uncovered. A document from Dr. Watts and a document from Dr. Nightingale out of Duke. Both those gentlemen filed affidavits. They were filed in the record in this case. And Dr. I will never pronounce this guy's name, Zuzuski, all of whom said that Hughes' evidence was false and misleading. And those are the affidavits that are in the record at the district court. Those are the affidavits that we referenced in our brief submitted to the court in our summary judgment motions and the ones in resisting summary judgment. So, frankly, Hughes himself doesn't deny that he did. He said, look, I'm not a biomechanical guy, I'm not a medical guy, and I can't give those opinions. But he did give those opinions. And as you know from our briefs, that occurred 10 times over 4 years in 8 or 9 different states. All these people lost their jobs. Almost all these people were 30-year-plus veterans of employment with perfect work records. So what we know is from Hughes himself that was true. We also have the emails from Norfolk Southern. I have to give great credit to Mr. Whitehead, counsel for NS, who provided about 1,000 pages of documents, and he did it honestly. And we looked at the emails, and the emails themselves are explicit about their criticisms of the fees. Now, unlike our representatives of the union, our guys are high school graduates, mostly, who represent these people at these disciplinary hearings. The people from Norfolk Southern who were reviewing the work of Hughes before it was used against our guys, those people are trained mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. They're trained engineers. They're not locomotive engineers. They're like Georgia Tech kind of engineers. And their engineering background enabled them to look at the draft reports of Hughes that were submitted to Norfolk Southern before they were used. And Norfolk Southern's internal engineers, Morelli, Kirby, a fellow named Jack Hughes, all said, whoa, look at this stuff. It's wrong. Engineer Hughes, the one we're complaining about, the work that he was submitting, his evidence was didn't understand the difference between G-forces and other force. He made these basic computational errors. One of the affidavits that we submitted from Dr. Nightingale looked at the mathematics alone that Mr. Hughes had used in the Kawa case and concluded if he's right with his math, this is document 44 at page document 4411, page 6, it said if his math was right, quote, in addition, an upward velocity of 40 feet per second would have shot an unrestrained occupant over two stories high in the air with 16 times the kinetic energy required for a neck fracture. The evidence in the case from the Hughes deposition alone in reenacting the Kawa case was a fellow was driving a truck and he hit a substantial bump in the road and he hit his head on the top of the cab. The guy in the back seat also hit his head on the top of the cab. Mr. Hughes was hired by Norfolk Southern to do a reenactment to figure out the mechanics of it as an expert. And at the end of the day, what did he do? He got in the truck. They knew the bump was coming. Instead of using a 6'2" driver, he had a 5'8" driver. He's sitting in the back seat without photometrics, no cameras to record it, no to measure it. He used a ruler and eyeballed it to see, well, how close would it be? And according to him, the critical moment of time was 0.3 of a second, 3/10 of a second. And he said, oh, there was 1-inch clearance.
You know, the injunction that the union seeks in its complaint seems to ask directly for procedures that the union tried to obtain and failed to obtain through the bargaining process. On appeal, the union appears to be asking for a slightly different injunction, that the employer not be allowed to use the Hughes reports or any other false expert reports. What exactly is the union asking for? And the bottom line question is the union, is the suit simply an end run around the bargaining process?
That's actually a wonderful question. I'm glad you asked it. What we wanted all along in this case was the behavior to stop.
What was that?
We wanted the behavior to stop. We wanted Richard T. Hughes evidence that's false and misleading to be stopped being used. We can't defend ourselves when they come in with no notice, throw down a 35-page report with our high school guys and say, oh, here's the physics, here's the math. Go ahead and defend yourself.
But your complaint, the whole complaint, is about the procedure. It's not fair, you say, basically. It's not fair. And frankly, you've talked sort of a cumulative thing of 10. I think, what are you just at? A couple of members of your union, right?
I think I believe 4 of them were members of our union and 6 were members of other crafts.
Yeah, and the other crafts, do they have a similar problem?
They didn't file a lawsuit.
Well, I wonder, though, how often does this Hughes guy get involved in what I would consider be fairly frequent accidents, especially when you're talking about across the country?
Well, when we filed the lawsuit, we said, look, this has gone on now for 4 years, 10 times. We finally caught on to it. This needs to stop. And the district court was wonderful in the sense that she let us take the 2 depositions we asked to take. Because we said, we'll put up or shut up. We'll take the depositions and we'll find out. But I'd like to go back and answer, if I can, the question.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt it. I thought that was the same line, but go ahead.
All right. So what is it we want? We want Richard T. use his evidence, false and misleading evidence, to be stopped being used. Well, the problem we've got is, how do you police that? At the end of the day, how do we know that what's being introduced is in fact fair, that it's not fraudulent. And in our view, the only way to do that, frankly, was to say, well, give us a 10-day head start. If you're going to use Richard Hughes or Buck Owens or whoever you decide to use, give us a 10-day head start. At least that way we can do our own due diligence.
We'll go back to the same point, the procedure. Apparently, you have 35,000 members, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
You're not able to achieve this at the bargaining table, apparently.
Well, with all due respect, I believe this is what would happen. Under the Railway Labor Act, if we want to collectively bargain, the issue about whether Norfolk Southern can use false and misleading evidence on property tribunals, we would serve a Section 6 notice, Section 6 of the Railway Labor Act. The Norfolk Southern would be obliged to sit down with us in a relatively prompt period of time and to negotiate. And we would fully expect that they would say the same thing they said to you, to the federal court, and to us all along, which is, no, we're not going to stop. We'll make no assurance. They even put it in their answer. They reserve the right to continue to do this.
Yeah, but what you want is really to get your point of view at the other end of the teeter-totter. I mean, so that you can challenge this and have your own expert and other people come in and do this rather than be surprised with what you describe your high school people against the...
Well, in our perfect world, what we would have happen is that Norfolk Southern wouldn't conduct itself this way.
Well, okay.
And therefore, we don't have the resources to go out and hire mechanical professional engineers to do accident reconstruction every time they show up with an expert. The system is supposed to be non-adversarial. The Railway Labor Act provision, the Norfolk Southern's own policies, which is a document in this case, says that they're supposed to develop a record in the disciplinary hearings, and the chips fall where they may. The railroad's got the obligation to provide all the evidence to show that the guy or gal didn't do the act as accused or did do the act, to develop all of the facts. It's supposed to be non-adversarial. But when they sit there and they know the facts and they don't tell us the facts, they don't disclose it, they've destroyed the non-adversarial aspect. And all of a sudden, the trade we made in 1934, which was we gave up the right to strike so we'd have a fair disciplinary process, that grand bargain goes out the window in this situation.
What did the other unions say?
Well, I wish I could speak for them. Actually,
I don't know who you speak for, but the problem is we, at least in my case, have to look at this as from a pretty much of a distance. And then you go to the arbitration, and apparently you don't like that either because those guys are only got one set of evidence, and so that doesn't do you any good, I guess.
Well, if you use the Gibson case, which Norfolk Southern does in their briefs, the Gibson case is their evidence that shows best how the process is supposed to work. And so in the Gibson case, engineer Richard T. Hughes gave his false and misleading evidence, and in that case it was a question of the fellow with the hard hat was hit on top of the head. Hughes said, well, he couldn't have been hurt in the way he said because, after all, the hat wasn't damaged. In deposition, basically, I asked Hughes, well, if I stand on your head and I don't damage the hat, are you going to have compression injuries? And he said, yes, of course he will. So in that case, the neutral didn't know anything about what his record was. He didn't know that there was a history of false and misleading evidence. He didn't know that the Norfolk Southern knew that there was false and misleading evidence being used. He didn't know the complaints that had been made to Norfolk Southern, by various unions. So the neutral was in no position to know any of those things. But what they do in those arbitral processes, which aren't really arbitrations, as we noted in the brief, they're really a form of appeals, what the neutral said was, I'm going to give credit to the credibility decision made by the management guys on the property. Well, those were the guys who were doing this dastardly deed to us in the first place. They didn't know. There's no way they could know.
Did you submit Powers as an expert in the district court?
We had not, but we had not gotten that far yet in the course of the course of litigation.
So on what basis did he offer his statement?
Well, we offered the affidavits, and the evidence that we had in his affidavit said he'd been doing this work for 25 years. He was the assistant to the president. He was in charge of the Chicago office over all arbitrations. He personally supervised all of the arbitrations. He testified that he had personal knowledge, and his affidavit said he had personal knowledge of all these things. He was the parallel person to Dennis Kirby from Labor Relations at Norfolk Southern. There's no difference between what they do. They just do it on opposite sides.
Let me take you somewhere a little different, because you made a rather strong claim at page 5 of the reply brief that if employees bring in lawyers to defend them, that Norfolk will call in the police to arrest the lawyers that were brought in to represent the accused workers at on property investigations. What's the basis of that rather alarming claim?
I was in Norfolk. I was in Dayton, Ohio, to represent a person in a non-property investigation designated by the president of the International Union and the general chairman, and they called the police on me. So that's the answer to that.
What were you doing?
I was trying to represent a fellow named Murphy and another fellow named Dillon in a non-property investigation that was highly contested. And at that point, we were making the point, which is Norfolk Southern has turned these non-adversarial proceedings into adversary proceedings, and now we should have
How
lawyers.
How are you trying to make the point?
By being present as a lawyer and representing our accused members.
So you were just there, so they came and picked you up?
We had given notice to the railroad that we were going
what
to...
What did you do?
I appeared in the hearing room. The hearing officer for Norfolk Southern said, everybody has to get out that's not a member of the BMWE. And I said, I'm here by designation, and you've known that by letter in advance. Yes. And they said, you're not going to be able to participate. And I said, under the contract, I have a right to be here. I am designated representative of the BMWE. And they called the police, and we adjourned.
You mean you refused to leave, and they called the police?
I'm not sure I said I refused to leave. I said I'm
you
authorized
just did.
I didn't leave.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
I just don't know what happened. I didn't know whether you got in a fist fight or, you know, it was a wrestling match or what the heck happened.
With all due respect, I'm past that point, I hope.
Who knows?
Truly.
Okay.
Truly.
I'll
reserve the rest of time for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. James Whitehead on behalf of Norfolk Southern. Since we're recounting history, Judge Bauer, I was admitted to this Court in 1974 when I was clerking for Judge Stevens, and I remember when you joined the Court in the December of 1974. So we all go back, Harry, to roughly the same period
here. What else do you remember?
Oh, I remember lots of things, Judge. In this lawsuit, BMWED is asking the federal courts to impose a host of new procedural and substantive obligations on Norfolk Southern with respect to the conduct of its on-the-property disciplinary investigation hearings. These are obligations that are not found in the collective bargaining agreement between the parties and that have not been agreed to by the parties as a result of collective bargaining.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that a railway employer is regularly committing, just the sake of argument, you better turn the white light off. Okay, because that's scary. Where was I?
That a railroad is admitting improper evidence.
Well, let's say the employer is regularly committing outright fraud, just for the sake of argument.
Yes.
In disciplinary proceedings, what would be the proper procedure for a union to seek a remedy for that? I mean, if a union noticed that the employer was submitting junk science from a hired gun, what could the union do to counter that? Let's say everything is, you know, true.
Your Honor, thank you for that question, because it goes to the focal point of the responsibilities and the rights of the parties under the Railway Labor Act. The law is clear, and there are several decisions that we have cited in our brief, that the exclusive remedy for alleged fraud, alleged false evidence that is used by a railroad on the property to discipline an employee, is for the union to raise that issue before the Railway Labor Act Arbitration Board to which the discipline is appealed, and that is the sole and exclusive remedy that the union has. I would direct Your Honor's attention to the decisions that we cite in our brief on this point, because they are uniform and they are they are uncontradicted. The primary one is actually a very scholarly opinion written by Judge Ann Williams, who is now, of course, a member of this court. That's the Hankin versus National Railroad Passenger Corporation decision, the Hankin case in 1987. She followed on the decision of Judge Hart in the Northern District in the Pitts versus a National Railroad Passenger Corporation case. All of these cases establish the principle and recognize the principle that the sole body that has the authority to review the evidence on which a carrier utilizes for purposes of disciplining an employee is a Railway Labor Act Arbitration Board, not a federal court. And as a result, the result is that what the union needs to do in any instance in which it believes the evidence is improper, incorrect, false, or even fraudulent based on these decisions, is it needs to raise those arguments to the Adjustment Board or to the Special Board of Arbitration that might have been appointed under Section 3(2) of the Railway Labor Act. Now, let's explain how that would have worked here, or should have worked here. You will be aware of the fact that in two of the cases, for example, the case involving Stephen Kawa and the case involving Mr. Gibson, Hughes reports were introduced at the investigation hearing. Now, let me be clear. The Hughes report is not simply a one-sentence letter from Engineer Hughes. It's a lengthy expert report that explains exactly what he did, exactly what authorities he is relying upon, and sets forth a lengthy curriculum vitae explaining his own qualifications to render these opinions. The union received all of this during the hearing. Now,
During the hearing, but not before.
That is correct. Not before, because under the collective bargaining agreement, neither party has the right to pre-hearing discovery. But they received the report at the hearing. What should the union do? Well, one option for the union would be then, at the close of the hearing, to submit the expert reports to its own experts for them to review them. In truth, they did that in this case. Of course, it was a year and a half after the arbitration award was done, but the union could submit the reports to its own experts. And if the experts disagreed with any aspect of the report, the conclusions, the methodology, or the findings of Engineer Hughes, the union had the right to submit its own expert reports as part of the on-the-property appeal process.
The same forum?
I beg your pardon?
The same forum there it was before?
Oh, yes.
Basically a continuance?
It would go to the when the decision is made to discipline, there are then internal appeals at the railroad. And if those internal appeals then don't resolve the matter, then it goes to arbitration. And so the union had the right to submit its own expert reports as part of the on-the-property appeals process. You'll recall that in the Kawa case, the union did just that. They submitted a report from a Mr. Tony Machetta on a different topic. It was on the subject of the purpose for some tie-downs on air seats, which happened to be relevant in the Kawa case. But the union knew that if it wanted to bring additional evidence to bear before the case goes off to arbitration, it had the right to do so as part of the appeal process. The union didn't do that here. They didn't send the Hughes reports to their own experts to have those experts opine on whether or not Mr. Hughes got it right or got it wrong. But they could have done so, and had they done so, those reports would have been part of the record that went to the Special Board of Adjustment, the Railway Labor Act Arbitration Board, and could have been the basis for arguments by the union that the Hughes report was not worth the paper it was printed on and shouldn't have been considered. That's what the union should have done. But the union did not do that.
Why?
Why? I don't know. We have no idea. In fact, the union first submitted these reports to their own experts for review a year after the Kawa arbitration award was issued. They've been filed in this case, these counter reports. Your honors can take a look at them, and you will see that those experts were able to make their counter arguments based upon a review of the comprehensive report that was put into the record by Norfolk Southern. There was no hiding of the ball here. Hughes' report set forth what he did, what scientific studies he relied upon, at the conclusions that he drew, and his own curriculum vitae setting forth his authority.
But would any entity other than a federal court have the power to enjoin a railway employer from knowingly using false expert reports in disciplinary proceedings?
Not to enjoin, but to avoid, but to set aside the discipline. That's the purpose of the Railway Labor Act Arbitration Boards. Under the Railway Labor Act, as your honors are aware, because all of you have sat on cases involving Railway Labor Act matters, I know.
But it's so hard.
But under the Railway Labor Act, Congress has decreed that the exclusive body to determine and to make final and binding decisions with respect to railroad discipline are not the federal courts. It's railroad arbitrators under Section 3 of the Railway Labor Act.
No, I want to make a distinction here. We're talking, this is because between minor and major. We haven't talked about that here. And it seems to me that what you're saying is this is a minor thing.
Absolutely.
And that's where, as I understand it, confined to the contract as opposed to going to statutory.
Well, as Your Honor may be aware from the brief, the argument that the union is now making in this court, that there are statutory obligations that are imposed,
that wasn't made in the district court. You're claiming that's waived, I guess.
Well, it is waived, but more importantly, it's wrong. Indeed, in 1930 and in 1937, within a decade of the passage of the Railway Labor Act, the Supreme Court of the United States, in the Texas and New Orleans case and the Virginian case, ruled that the Railway Labor Act does not impose any restrictions on the railroad's ability either to hire or to dismiss or discharge its employees. The sole source of any obligations that are imposed on the railroad in connection with the disciplinary procedures come not from the Railway Labor Act, but from the contract. In this court, in its Edwards decision, its seminal Edwards decision, almost 50 years ago, made that point absolutely clear, that there's nothing in the Railway Labor Act that governs the process that the railroad utilizes in its on-property hearings or disciplinary matters. Any obligations that the railroad has in that regard comes solely from the collective bargaining agreement, not from the Railway Labor Act.
Well, they claim they have no leverage there for some reason.
Well, Your Honor, they have the same leverage in collective bargaining that the railroad does. The collective bargaining process is prescribed by the Railway Labor Act. As Mr. Zanville acknowledged, the union could serve a Section 6 notice to commence bargaining over proposals that these prophylactic measures that they are requesting a court to impose be agreed to in collective bargaining. And at the end of the day, after the exhaustion of those bargaining processes, and they are lengthy, but they are prescribed by Congress, at the conclusion of that process, if an agreement can be reached, it's reached. And if an agreement cannot be reached, then the union has the right to strike. They have the right to attempt to enforce their bargaining obligations by a lawful strike at the conclusion of the major dispute resolution process. Your Honor may be aware, we discussed it in our brief.
When does it get to be major instead of minor?
It is a major dispute, Your Honor, when a party is attempting to change an existing agreement, as opposed to enforce its rights under the agreement. A minor dispute is a situation in which there is a dispute over whether the existing agreement has or has not been violated by a carrier's action.
And from their point of view, they want us to, I guess, rewrite the contract.
They do want to rewrite the contract, absolutely. And in fact, as Judge Kendall quite properly ruled in the district court, as pled in this case, remember the union's argument in the district court was that we were violating contractual due process, that we weren't providing our employees with the fair and impartial hearing that the current contract required. Now, Norfolk Southern's response was, Judge, the collective bargaining agreement doesn't impose these pre-hearing discovery obligations. The collective bargaining agreement doesn't require the railroad to comply with the Daubert standard for the admission of expert evidence. And we produced evidence of the past practices of the parties, both parties, under the current agreement, that it admitted expert evidence without pre-hearing discovery and without complying with Daubert. The BMWE did it. We did it. And we presented the arbitration decisions not only on our property but across the industry, establishing that the common law of the industry, rail industry, is that unless a collective bargaining agreement requires pre-hearing discovery, there is no right to it. The court, Judge Kendall, properly concluded, therefore, that our position was at least arguable, and that is the Conrail standard for establishing this to have been a minor rather than a major dispute.
But let me go back. If a railway employer was knowingly using false expert reports at disciplinary hearings, that would still be a minor one under the RLA?
Yes, it would, Judge, and that's exactly what the decisions I mentioned, the Hankin decisions and others, establish. What those decisions establish is that the sole body that has the authority to review rule upon and determine the sufficiency, quality, admissibility, or even in an appropriate case, the fraudulent nature of the evidence that the railroad relies upon is the arbitration board. In the Hankin case, for example, the allegation was that the employers on the property were submitting perjured testimony. Perjured testimony at the hearing. In fact, the union, I think the employee in that case, came in with an affidavit from the witness who said, my testimony was perjured. What ultimately, the arbitration board upheld the discipline. And the employee then appealed to federal court, to Judge Williams. And what Judge Williams ruled, based upon all of the precedent from this court, the Edwards case, the Pawlowski case, on which I believe you sat, Judge Mannion, all of this precedent establishes that the sole body that has the authority to determine whether or not the evidence was good or bad, whether it was false or fraudulent, whether it was sufficient or insufficient, is the Railroad Arbitration Board, and that the sufficiency of the evidence is not appropriately reviewed by a federal district court. But the Seventh Circuit cases are legion on that point.
What's the status of the Orenglista appeals before the NRAB?
My understanding is that they have been submitted to the NRAB, that written submissions have been made to that entity. I don't believe a hearing before the NRAB has yet been held in that case. But the point, I'm glad you mentioned that, Judge, because the union has the ability to raise whatever concerns it had about the Hughes report in the Orenglista case to the NRAB, to the arbitrators. That's the appropriate body to review this question, not the federal district court.
Of course, now, the federal district court here completely disregarded union's evidence.
No, Judge. She didn't. In fact, you will find in the federal district court opinion, both here and in the, and particularly in the Kawa opinion that Judge Kendall wrote, that there was no basis, there was no evidence submitted to establish that the Hughes report was fraudulent. But more importantly, what Judge Kendall focused on was, did she have, was she the right body to be even thinking about this? Did the federal court have the authority to second-guess the determination of the arbitration board in that case that the evidence was insufficient? And what Judge Kendall ruled in the Kawa arbitration review case was that sufficiency of the evidence is not a basis for reviewing the decision. And as a but she found in that case that the union had not submitted evidence of fraud. Let me speak for just a moment about your concern about whether there is evidence of fraud in this case, because the answer is no. There is no evidence of fraud. At most, what we have is a situation in which there is a disagreement between the experts. Certainly, the opinions of the experts that the union belatedly showed up with, they should have submitted it to the arbitration board, but they did not. But certainly, those opinions are inconsistent with Mr. Hughes. They conclude that Mr. Hughes got it wrong. All right, we all know that frequently in litigation, there are disputes between experts as to who's properly analyzed the facts and who has not. But there's no evidence that Mr. Hughes's reports were false or knowingly false or fraudulent. Now, the union, Mr. Zambel refers to certain emails that we produced, and thankfully he's given us credit for doing the right thing and producing all of the evidence he requested. Of course we did. Those emails were comments on preliminary drafts of Hughes's reports in other cases. And did those I suspect that your honors are not surprised by the fact that when an expert prepares a report for a client, frequently a preliminary report is sent to the client for the client's review. And the client sometimes said, hey, I think this area needs to be strengthened. Or I'm confused about what you're saying here. Or what you're saying over here, I'm not sure, is that right or not? And what those emails say is that we think the reports need to be clarified. They need to be strengthened. We don't think that they're sufficient by themselves. That's what those emails say. There's no statement in any of those emails that anything was knowingly false, and certainly nothing to suggest that it was fraudulent. And yet the union, in its brief to this court, as it did in the district court, alleges that this is the greatest fraud in the history of the Railway Labor Act. My goodness. When I was a seventh grader, this is back in the bad old Cold War days, we had a unit on propaganda. We talked about all sorts of propaganda tools. And one was something called the big lie, if I recall correctly, from my seventh grade social studies. And that is the notion that if you say something often enough and you yell it loud enough, somebody may believe it. Well, I'm sorry, but I happen to submit that the assertion that what the railroad is doing here is knowingly fraudulent and it's the worst fraud in the history of the Railway Labor Act is as good an example of the big lie as I can come up with.
Well, what is so sort of messy here is that, I mean, it's almost as if we've got you fellows writing about two different cases. You know, the union's case is about systemic fraud that's perpetrated by the employer at hearings through the knowing use of false testimony. And your case is about whether the collective bargaining agreement affords a right to pre-hearing discovery or any rights other than those spelled out in the CBA. I mean, they really are...
Ships passing in the night, is that Your Honor's suggestion? Yeah. Well, perhaps they are. But the reason that there are ships passing in the night, sadly, is because the union has ignored 50 years of decisions from this court, starting with the Edwards case, the Pawlowski case that I mentioned, Judge Mannion was on the panel for, that have established that the Railway Labor Act simply does not establish any obligations or prescribe the procedures to be used at the railroad on property hearings, or any standards of the evidence that the railroad relies upon. Your Honors, the reasons the ships are passing in the night is because 50 years of precedent has been simply ignored by the union. They don't talk about these cases. They don't talk about the cases that have established that nothing in the Railway Labor Act governs the procedures that are to be used in the on-property hearing, that's exclusively for the railroad arbitrators to review. It's exclusively for collective bargaining. I had the quote from the Edwards decision. The provisions of the Railway Labor Act govern neither the procedure by which a carrier may discharge its employees nor the conduct of an investigation hearing on railroad property. That's what this court ruled in Edwards. It's been cited approvingly by this court and by every other circuit since its decision in 1956. I found it intriguing that 2 years ago, the BMWED sent a memorandum to the occupational safety and health folks at the Department of Labor. We have it in the appendix. The memorandum was BMWED's explanation of how the Railroad Labor Act disciplinary procedures work. And in that memorandum, BMWED made the following statement. Quote, "The courts have made it clear that the Railway Labor Act does not prescribe due process procedures for conducting a hearing on the railroad property. And thus the quantum and quality of due process at the disciplinary hearing is governed by the collective bargaining agreement, that is, that which the union was able to bargain in a forum, collective bargaining, where compromise is irrelevant." That's what BMWED told the Department of Labor 2 years ago. They're singing a different story now. In footnote 4 of the reply brief, the union attempts to ask you to disregard that memorandum, those conclusions. Why? Because they were written by a non-lawyer. I'm afraid this is one of those charming situations in which it was the non-lawyer who correctly stated the law. Your Honor, the district court got it right. If the union believes that the current bargaining agreement grants it these rights, it needs to present that in a minor dispute arbitration. Otherwise, this matter needs to be resolved through collective bargaining, but not by judicial fiat. The court has no further questions.
Thank you. Would you be kind enough to give Mr. Zanville an extra minute because Ms. Roypack got one.
Thank you very much. There is no procedural device in the Railway Labor Act appellate tribunal process, such as Rule 60 under the Federal Rules of Procedure. So once fraud has been committed, it's a done deal. There's no way to reopen it. 6 months, a year, 5 years, it doesn't matter. You can't reopen it. The damage is done. So your question, Your Honor, was effectively, if this court doesn't enjoin the behavior, where could it be stopped? It's not going to get stopped at the National Railroad Adjustment Board or the SBA or BLBs. Can't be done. They can't stop what they don't know about. We're not going to know about it. Why did it take us so long to figure it out? Well, Our guys assume, and the law permits them to assume, that no fraud is going to be perpetrated against them. There's a case in our brief that we cited that says that effectively is the law in the Seventh Circuit. It makes sense it should be that way. Plus, it's a non-adversarial system. It's supposed to be fast. The trade-off in the Railway Labor Act is, it's one of those, every court that looks at it for purposes of collateral estoppel, for purposes of res judicata, for purposes of preemptive effect, looks at the Railway Labor Act and holds its nose and says, well, that's the process you guys kind of have, and it works well enough for the day-to-day operations of your disputes. So, you know, we're not going to mess with it. It's kind of okay. But there are cases that go too far. And in this particular case, the U.S. District Court sort of demonstrated the too far in the Union Pacific case in 2009, where that case was, five engineered cases came up from the National Railroad Adjustment Board. And the question was, well, did the parties confer before it went to the Adjustment Board? Because if they didn't, there was no jurisdiction to hear the case. The district court in that case held, the fact that they agreed that there was no conferencing means I can't review it even, and I don't find that unfair, even though the facts, in fact, were that they did confer. The Seventh Circuit reversed the district court in that case. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2009, which unanimously, it's not something they do a lot, unanimously reversed, upheld the Seventh Circuit reversing the district court. We're seeing a different breed of cases. I cite in the courts, in our brief to this court, a Ninth Circuit case where we had a railroad threaten the arbitrator. They were going to rule in favor of a union, and the threat was, if you rule that way, we're never going to hire you again. We're seeing a different day and age, unfortunately. We're seeing conduct we've never seen before. So Mr. Whitehead can talk about the big lie and he can talk about propaganda. We weren't the ones that went out and did this. We've been trying to defend against it, and we're asking ourselves, how do we do that? These are ships in the night briefs. They are completely different in every regard. But what do they have? This court doesn't have to look at Edwards to solve this case and to answer the question, do you have power to deal with it? Of course you do. C&W was decided after Edwards. The Supreme Court in C&W, as late as it was in 1971, finally said, oh, by the way, there's an enforceable duty of good faith to bargain and to make and maintain agreements and to settle all disputes. That's C&W in 1971, substantially after Edwards. Edwards would not have been decided that way, but for the decision of C&W. And so in our brief to this court, we said, follow C&W, which says, look, when they wrote the Railway Labor Act, they thought new stuff was going to happen. You can't legislate everything. You can't govern everything. You're supposed to use the federal common law, fill in the interstices. Let's figure out solutions when problems arise. Well, we're here on that rare occasion when we show up saying, we need help. We can't stop this. Why in the world would they refuse to stop doing this? They're doing it because they think they've got the power to. You know, we talk about turnabout as fair play. In the Fifth Circuit, Norfolk Southern and all the other railroads got together and they made this argument. They made the argument, we don't have to be bound by the exact language of the Railway Labor Act to get an injunction. We're going to use it. They used C&W and got the Fifth Circuit to agree that injunction could be issued, even though the statute doesn't allow it. And what the remedy they sought and they received was this: a 10-day notice before we would ever strike. We've asked for a 10-day notice of the use of this kind of evidence to protect ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much as well, Mr. Whitehead.